This is a HeadGum Podcast.
It's my nature box. What do you think, guys? Is that a timely parody? Am I on the right track here? Here we are, guys. Well, you know what we got to talk about. We got to talk about the box of nature. That is Nature Box. Nature Box has the most delicious snacks on the planet. It's as simple as that. And it's going to make your snacking dreams a reality and will change the way you snack forever. Don't you want to change the way you snack? Aren't you a little dissatisfied? Like, I could be snacking better. Well, now you can with Nature Box, dude. My personal favorites include stuff like the mini Belgian waffles, because I like yummy sweet stuff. I got a bit of a sweet tooth. Is that a fun character? Hi, I'm Clem, and I got a bit of a sweet tooth. So Clem, if he wanted to satisfy his sweet tooth, he could get some of that vanilla almond granola. He could get the mini Belgian waffles, all sorts of stuff. Or for the savory things, he could get stuff like, oh, I don't know, the jalapeno white cheddar popcorn. It's got so many ridiculously delicious snacks to choose from, and they get delivered straight to your doorstep. And Nature Box is full of the flavor, but without any of the junk. Just fun, flavorful snacks made with ingredients that you can distrust. No, that you can trust. You can be like, hey, ingredients, I trust you. You're good. You're not crummy. So right now, you can enjoy your first box of Nature Box on them, on Nature Box. You go to naturebox.com/Gilmore Guys. Gotta act fast. You can't act slow. Can't be a little shlomo about it. naturebox.com/Gilmore Guys. Enjoy your first Nature Box on them. Go there right now to unbox a world of taste and a possibility. One last time, that's naturebox.com/Gilmore Guys. For your first box of Beyond Tasty hand-picked snacks sent direct to your doorstep. Oh yeah. You wanna harmonize? Kind of. Yeah.
I didn't know if you were going up or I should go.
Tale as old as time, am I right?
Well, yeah.
Welcome to Gilmore Guys and a special episode we call a Gilmore Gab. Little Gilly Gab. I'm Kevin.
I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Gilmore Guys. Guys, thank you for joining us for another episode of the show. We've had a lot of fun here. We've had a lot of laughs, a lot of love.
See, that's what you say when you're closing out the show. So
guys, what a day it's been.
What an episode.
Let's wrap it up. So we have had the honor and the thrill and the pleasure to talk to so many people in doing this show. We have talked to, I mean, the names are endless. Kelly Bishop, Keiko Agena, Stacey Oristano.
Right. Scott Patterson.
Patterson?
Patterson.
Okay, Patterson.
Right.
Scoot Patterson.
Scoot Patterson.
And, but nothing could prepare us and prepare you for what we have today. Ladies and gentlemen, he needs an introduction, but we're going to give him one anyway.
La la.
Come on.
La la. Special guest.
Ooh, kind of in the background. Well, you may know him as Kirk Gleason on Gilmore Girls. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Sean Gunn.
Hello.
Hello.
Guys, thanks for having me.
Oh,
of course.
Thank you so much. Do we want to share kind of the long and storied origin story?
I think we should.
Of how this interview came together?
Yeah, I was trolling you guys on Facebook.
Yeah.
But even before that, we were talking before we started recording. Demi went to an episode of Doug Loves Movies.
Where you were the surprise guest with James, your brother, and Michael Rooker, I believe?
Correct.
Yes.
Mr. Rooker. And you
like herding cats, being on being on a podcast with Michael Rooker is...
Oh yeah, is that tough?
Bananas, but
it was great though.
And then Demi, this was probably like what, a month or two into us doing our show.
Yeah.
We were just two little boys doing a little podcast, and Demi approached you and said, like, oh, excuse me, Mr. Gunn, what did you say?
It was okay, so basically I was there with my friend and someone mentioned that you were on Gilmore Girls, and she turns to me and goes, you got to get him on the show. And I was like, no, stop it. Because I was like, he wouldn't do it. So after this, she like wouldn't leave me alone. I was like, go talk to him. So I calmly walked up to you. I was like, hey, Sean, big fan. I actually do a podcast about Gilmore Girls. And we'd love to have you on sometime. And we exchanged contact info.
That's right. And then I never heard from you again.
And then
yes.
You never heard from us because still at the time we were like, oh, you know, we're not big enough. We're not good enough to have Mr. Sean Gunn on.
To be fair to you guys, I might not have done it back then because I didn't know. You know, I get people ask me to do different things and I didn't know anything about it at that time. But then since then, I've heard so many great things about your podcast.
That's so nice.
So then I was like, then I started to get my feelings hurt a little bit. And I was like, they asked me to be on it. And then they changed their minds. Like, what happened? I've never heard from them again.
Well, we were in New York. And then I was at a show. And then after I got out, my phone was blowing up with texts from like Mara and other people because you posted on your Facebook, why the hell? What did it say? Why the hell haven't the Gilmore guys invited me on?
Yeah,
yet?
Why haven't they invited me on the show? And then I got a couple messages from people who were like, "Oh, I have their contact information. Here it is." And I'm like, "No, no, no. You don't understand. I'm not asking to contact them. I want to know why they haven't contacted
exactly.
me."
Yeah. No, invite yourself on Gilmore Guys.
I'm honestly very scared if we had done it as soon as we got your contact info, it would have just been like, so I'm like a season into the show. What do you think is next for
well,
Kirk?
That's true, too, because at the time, you weren't even in the main credits as a character.
So that makes sense.
Demi's watching it for the first time.
Right.
And so to kind of get into like the ins and outs of your character.
You haven't gotten to the part where Kirk gets decapitated yet.
No.
Yeah.
I hear that's season six.
Season six. I mean, really, the way Amy left it was like, oh, what's going to happen?
That's really horrifying.
To his head.
Really disturbing.
Season seven, they glue his head right back on and he's normal.
Nothing ever happened. It was the gas leak season.
What a nice time.
But yeah, so that was a concern too. But anyway, that thread though was so funny.
That was,
on your
really
Facebook.
Fun.
Because I think the first comment was from David Sutcliffe and he just said, like, you know, Chris on the show, he said, ask Mara. Then Mara was commenting. And then I think John got into it. Yeah.
It was very surreal for us. We were just like, oh my God.
Sorry. But then.
It was fun though.
It came together.
I'm glad to be here.
I know. We're so glad to have you, man. Like, it's been, yeah. Kirk is obviously one of our favorite characters
for
the show. A fan favorite.
Thank
absolutely.
You very much. And I was saying, I've been listening to your show now. I like it very much. And I have to. But there's one thing I have to say is that I was listening to the Scott Patterson show, and I noticed you kept asking him about actors that he worked with, and he's like, oh, you know, Michael Winters, the greatest, classically trained actor, as am I, incidentally, but classically trained actor, he's the greatest, Liz Torres, Sally Struthers, and I'm listening, I'm like going on a walk and listening, I'm like, what about me, Scott, what about me? And you could see I can get an inferiority complex about this. I'm like, what, you know, you're not going to mention me? And so he doesn't say anything about me. I'm like, okay, fine. And then, Kevin, you say to him, you're like, you know, Sean Gunn is a guy who we really enjoyed your scenes with, and just radio silence. He doesn't even say, he doesn't even say like, oh, he's got a good personality or, you know, like he's a nice person. So I think I now officially have beef with Scott Patterson.
Wow.
As well.
We started Gilmore Girls.
You're
cast
gonna see
beef.
That on people.
I'm 90% kidding and 10% a little bit like, really, man? Not even one shout out?
Well, Scott's on Twitter now, so if he wants to address this beef, he can.
Yeah. Although his Twitter got hacked, but then it got unhacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guys, please don't tweet at Scott Patterson about this. I do not want to start
this
a beef.
Clipped out.
Yeah.
Or we could start the, it could be like the Huckabee thing on Colbert and Stewart and Conan from a few years ago.
Where he has to come on the show to settle it.
Yeah, that's right. Or Scott and Sean like throw down
Ooh.
To
yeah.
like, all right, let's do this.
I would love to get you two in a ring.
The truth is I loved working with Scott and I would have said his name if you would ask me actors that I liked working with.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sean.
Oh, well, what are you going to do?
Well, let's start, you know, because I think part of our purpose in doing this and doing the show is to give not only a picture of like Gilmore Girls as a whole as the show, but then also to give a picture of the people who worked on it as whole individual people and kind of where Gilmore Girls fits in to your life, to your story, to your career, personal life and everything. Because for some people, Gilmore Girls is like, oh, that's the thing that they're in and that's what they're about. But mm-hmm. then for the people who worked on the show and acted in it, it's like, oh, that's a part of my life. But, you know, it plays a different role in everyone's narrative. So yeah. Where did you grow up? Where'd you come from?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, or just outside St. Louis in the suburbs. I'm the youngest of six.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And my parents just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary a few weeks ago.
Congrats.
That's awesome.
A little sunburned. I was at their lake house in central Missouri. I've pretty much always, I've always been an actor. I mean, since I was old enough to know what a profession was, I said I wanted to be an actor. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been sort of working towards that in one way or another. And my experience with Gilmore Girls is very unusual, I think. I mean, I came on as a co-star, you know. I didn't even have a guest star role.
And you were a different name when you came on.
Yeah,
I
was.
You were Mick.
You know, please, if you ever get a chance to interview Amy, please ask her why she changed the character's name, because it's one of the questions I get most frequently, and I don't know the answer.
Can I tell you my theory as to why?
What?
I kind of have a theory, too.
This is no bit done. Is I think because her dad was a comedian. I believe he was a bit of an actor himself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was.
And he was on, I want to say All in the Family.
He did a bunch of shows, I think, in the 60s
and 70s. Yeah, 60s and 70s. And I think in All in the Family, he played multiple roles. Mm-hmm. And he was still that guy, but he was just like, this week he's the janitor, and this week he's the chef, and this week... So I think I've read, and I can't cite it because I don't remember what it was, but I think that was kind of the impetus for that, and that's why your character ended up having so many jobs.
It was definitely how it came about, because I know mm-hmm. that Jamie Rudofsky knew that story about Amy's father and then pitched the idea to Amy that I would keep coming back.
Oh, we probably heard it from Jamie.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
The citation, this very podcast.
but if that were the thing, then I my name didn't keep changing, though, because then she stuck with Kirk, and so I kind of didn't know. And I remember when I did the second episode that I did, where I was the Swan guy, I had to ask. You know, I just got booked. They're like, okay, they want you again to do mm-hmm. another role, and I'm like, am I the same character or am I a new character?
Oh, that was confusing.
And I didn't know.
Then, yeah.
Like I just showed up on set and I was kind of figuring it out as I went along. So it was unusual. My theory is this. My theory is that Amy maybe didn't remember that my character had the name Mick.
That's what I was going to say.
And that she thought I had just been the cable guy and then the Swan guy. And then by the time she decided, I like this guy, I'm going to make him part of the fabric of the town, I'm going to give him a name, and that name is Kirk, and she didn't realize that she had already given me a name. Mm-hmm. Or she did realize she'd given me a name and was like, I don't like that name, Mick. I prefer the name Kirk, and nobody's going to remember anyway. And of course, everyone remembers.
And that's the one thing everyone remembers about this show.
I get asked that question all the time.
That's so funny. So I think that's where it came out of. So you were acting, you said, from a very young age, pretty much ever since you knew what professions were.
That's true. I always wanted to be an actor. I was very outgoing as a kid. I liked being the center of attention and being the youngest of a large family.
I relate to that. I'm the youngest of three as well.
There you go.
That's why we're all here.
And
I can't
get
relate
plays
to
in high school. I would always get cast in the musicals as the really good character part who couldn't sing because I can't sing.
Were you a fan of musicals?
Oh, I love musicals. I still do.
Gotcha.
I could sing. I sing anyway, even though I can't sing.
Yeah. Well, you can do the Rex Harrison thing where you just speak everything.
Yeah.
Let a woman in your life. I'm doing Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, season 5. That must have been fun.
That's like my favorite episode, maybe.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think that's probably so fun. Is. Have you gotten there yet?
No.
No, we're about 15 away.
Oh, okay. So it's like 5:15?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
But yeah, so I did plays in high school, and then I went, and auditioned for various conservatory theater programs and got into the Goodman School of Drama, the illustrious Goodman School of Drama mm-hmm. in Chicago at DePaul University, and went there. It's a 4-year acting program, really cutthroat. When I was there, they used to cut people at the end of every year. And so
not literally
super competitive. Yeah, no, I know, but they did. But like you would get on warning and they would have, you know, there was only 55 of us or whatever when we started. And then by the time we graduated, there was like 22 of us.
Wow.
Through people leaving on their own. And then also maybe, you know, 5 to 10 people a year would actually just get not asked back to the program.
So it's a real badge of honor, just
which is
to
ridiculous,
survive.
By the way. Look, as a grown up now, I look back at that and I'm like, what a silly way to treat people who are still essentially children. But that's neither here nor there. So I got out of a conservatory in Chicago and started a theater company with some of my friends from school, one of whom is John Cabrera.
Oh, yes. Mr. Brian Fuller.
Brian, yes. On Gilmore Girls. And started doing a bunch of commercials, did a couple of really bad independent features, and realized that I needed to be in L.A., and moved to L.A. and kind of started working. Had about 6 months of nothing, but then started working, which is pretty quick for L.A. And I was doing a lot of co-stars and guest stars. I did a couple of nothing that was really sticking, but you know, I did this show called Brutally Normal for the WB that didn't last, but I was a recurring character and did.
I'm not familiar with that show. What was that all about?
It was with Mike Damas and Eddie K. Thomas about. It was just a high school sort of comedy show. I think it lasted 5-6 episodes. Mm-hmm. You know, they shot a dozen or whatever, and 6 made it there. It was nothing, you know, that was really on the radar for anyone. Even though I'm still friends with those guys, and did a show called Going to California, that also didn't last, but I was a recurring character and a bunch of guest spots. Like, you know, I was booking at a pretty high rate. And this is leading to my audition for Gilmore Girls, which one of the interesting things about it was that my agent recommended that I pass on the audition.
Oh.
Because I had just gotten to the place where I was doing guest stars instead of co-stars, which are, I don't know if you know about all the ins and outs of how that works, but the guest star is a more, you know, it pays more, and it's more like you're you know, you're generally working more than one day. You're going to have a small supporting role on the episode, whereas a co-star might be somebody who has one line or two lines or whatever.
Right.
And the DSL installer, which was the name of the role that I auditioned for in Gilmore Girls, was a co-star role. And so my agent recommended that I pass on it. And my manager at the time, Gordon Penn, had a good relationship with Mara Casey. They knew each other from Chicago. And he said, I think you should go in on this audition because Mara's great and it would be good to meet her and Jamie. And you know, so what if your agent doesn't want you to do it? And I said, well, let me look at the scene. If I like the scene, of course I'll go in. And I looked at it and I'm like, oh, I get this. This is funny. And I knew right away. I got it. I read the scene and I got the style. I'm like, okay, this is old time film comedy a la Preston Sturges and Howard Hawks. And this is exactly how this is written. I'm a big fan of that world. And so I know what to do with the material. And I got the job and had a great time working with Lauren and felt like the scene was really funny and just sort of assumed that was that. And then a few weeks later, they called and said, oh, Gilmore Girls is booking you again. It's a different guy. It's a swan guy.
Swan guy. Swans.
And as I said, and then it was like, well, you know, wait, what? How? Huh? Am I the same guy? Wait, how does this work?
Did they have you audition again, or was it just like they were?
No, they just offered me the part then at that point. It was like they, you know, I've since heard the rest of the story, which I know Jamie has told here on the show, but that Jamie had the idea of bringing me back and sort of having it be that I'm the guy in town who couldn't hold a job or would pop up from here and there. And Amy's dad was like that. She wasn't sure if she liked the idea or not, but she slept on it or, you know, took the weekend and then came in and said, yeah, go ahead and hire Sean Gunn. And then from there, I just kept getting offers to come in and do episodes. And I honestly thought, I really honestly thought that every episode I did was the last one I was going to do.
Every single one.
For the entire first season.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until they, maybe right at the end of the first season and then into the second season when I started feeling like I had a place, a specific place on the show that was starting to make sense to me. When I was like, oh, I think they're gonna keep me around.
Yeah, and that's got to be hard too, because in every performance that you give in every episode is essentially your audition to come back for the next episode. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that's
exactly
gotta be
nerve
wracking,
right.
A lot of pressure.
It's exactly. Well, yeah, I think that's true, but I also, you know, like, in some ways, I didn't appreciate how great of a job it was for a little while. I think I sort of thought, this is a great thing to be doing on the side while I look for my bigger job as a series regular on a TV show, you know, and was still auditioning for other stuff and still thought that, like, oh, well, I'm going to get a bigger job and have to leave this show. I'm glad that didn't happen. But it, in some ways, I think maybe it might have, as you said, I was auditioning to return on the show, which is partly true, but it also may have contributed to the quality of my work improving a little bit, because I felt like I had very little to lose. Every episode sort of seemed like a bonus. Every next episode, I'm like, wow, another one? That's great. It just seemed like a bonus. I did not think that I was going to be with the show for 7 years, you know?
Did you know how the reception was from fans to Kirk in that first season?
No. In fact... No, well, I thought that I knew. I thought that I knew that it was the opposite of what it was, because a running joke that I had with my family and friends at the time, until towards the end of season two, something that kept happening to me was I would meet people and I would say, I'm an actor. And they'd say, oh, have I seen you in anything? Which is such an annoying question. But
right.
I always want to say, well, you list to me everything you've seen, and when you get to something I've been in, I'll stop you. But they say, have I seen you in anything? And I would say, well, you know, right now I'm doing this TV show, Gilmore Girls. And over again, I would get the response, oh, yeah, I've seen that show. I like it. I've never seen you. Like, I would get people saying, like, yeah, oh, yeah, I know that show. I haven't seen you on it. I haven't, like... And that kept happening to me over and over. So I thought, I'm just under the radar. Nobody's, you know, I'm comic relief. In some ways, I felt like I was comic relief just for Amy, you know?
And like she was editing you out and just keeping the dailies, like, you know? This guy's great.
And so, no, I did not feel like I was a popular character at all. And then it all kind of happened at once. Then it all kind of, like, somewhere around the middle of season two, I started getting recognized, and I started, you know, they gave me a few more, like, they gave me bigger scenes to do, where my character actually had a backstory a little bit, and...
Right, when you find out all of his brothers and sisters, and the
right,
stuff with his mom.
Which to this day, that's, like, my favorite episode, my favorite scene, I think, that I've ever done on the show is the basket episode.
The basket scene.
With Jackson on that bench, because that was the scene when I read it, I was like, oh, I think I'm here to stay on this show.
Oh,
you know, and it was a long scene. It was like a you know, a page and a half or 2 page scene or whatever, which I didn't get those. I was getting a line here and a line there up until then, and it indicated that I had a backstory and that my character had been in the town his whole life and all that. And I love that scene. I still love it. Actually, I go back and I watch that scene. I love it. I think it really works too.
Yeah, it's very humanizing in that way. And it is one of those things where, as a viewer, when you watch it, you think, oh, okay, they want us to invest in this guy.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of permission for you as an actor to invest in your performance and just what you're doing on the show.
Absolutely.
And then it's permission for us too to be like, okay, we can, like, you know, not like it's Game of Thrones and you might get killed off next week, but, you know, some of the characters
can expect to see more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then by the end of season two, going into season three, became...
Yes, I became a series regular.
Yeah.
So then what happened was at the end of season two, I started to be a little more aware of my, you know, my value to the show, if I can say that with humility.
We can say it. Your value to the show.
But I was still auditioning, and I auditioned, and I had two TV shows, neither of which made it to the air, but two TV shows that I was testing for mm-hmm. to be a series regular. And if I had gotten those jobs, it would have been a 6-year contract and I would have been done.
Right.
And so when Amy and the producers of Gilmore Girls found out that that was going on, they were like, oh, we can't just keep asking him back with the assumption that he'll be there. You know, so then they made me an offer and they made me a series regular, which was awesome. I mean, to this day, it's like, I can't imagine that any jump in my career will ever be bigger than that one, than going from being an episode to episode actor on a variety of shows to then all of a sudden being a series regular on a hit TV show.
Yeah. And your agent that told you to pass because it was a co-star.
Yes.
By then.
Who is long gone. By the way.
Gotcha.
No, they were very nice. And I actually I kind of get it actually. Partially because, you know, They're right. The WB was sort of a mid-major network, but they would cut costs all the time. And honestly, that scene that I did is probably closer to being a guest star type scene. And so they looked at that and said, "This is a long scene. This is, you know, it's an important little comedy scene. And this guy, we want to establish you as an actor who only does guest stars." It's all the political bullshit of television. Right. But I get where they were coming from. It's not the dumbest thing in the world that they wanted me to pass, but, you know.
So you become a series regular in season 3.
Yes.
And from then on, was there like a shift in either like your performance or the way people treated you, or just like yeah. was it just kind of, we'll
yeah, speak it's, to it's, that. It's, you know, it's night and day. When you're a series regular, you get so much higher on the totem pole. You know, on television, it's like the actors are sort of up there with, you know, oftentimes the director even, you know, or the producers. They're the people who are series regulars are really important parts of the show. You know, guest stars come and go. And so, yeah, I remember that from my point of view, the being in the opening credits was what I really wanted. Like that was a huge deal to me. I wanted a parking spot, which is ludicrous. I wanted a parking spot with my name on it on the lot, which is like
it means
who cares,
a lot.
But I got it. And I wanted to be in the opening credits, like having my face and showing. I knew that was really important. And that was really exciting too, but yeah, it makes a big difference. You're treated a little bit differently by everyone.
And then in season 2, you kind of got to play some meatier stuff. The thing with you with Kirk having a crush on Lorelai and having to sort through that.
Yeah,
and you know, so I wonder. I mean, obviously they're going to keep using you. You know, whether or not they had to make you a series regular. But I wonder if that shift made it like it gave permission to the creators to be like, okay, let's give him some more stuff. Let's give him some more like interesting things to play. Even to the point where, you know, because Kirk sometimes on the show, we've talked about before, functions as a Job-like character, like just cannot catch a break in a lot of ways. So we are so delighted when like, oh, he found Lulu, and he gets to play, you know, he gets to be in love. Oh, he seems pretty good at this, and especially at the end of season 5 when you find out how loaded he actually is and everything.
Yeah, I love that. I was always, one of my favorite things would be getting the script delivered and looking at my front doorstep and the envelope and the script would be in there, and I would know I'm doing something in there, and I don't know what it is, but I'm in there doing something. It was really exciting. And I would read the script, and then sometimes it would be like, you know, it'd be like one shot of me doing yoga or something like that.
I don't remember the Kirk yoga scene.
There is no, it was like exercising. I remember because it was the episode where I had the very least to do.
I'm impressed that Stars Hollow even has like a yoga place.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Miss Patty's trying to get that off the ground.
But I loved it when, you know, I mean, I'm an actor. I love to work, and so when I would have really good scenes like the ones you mentioned, the you know, having a crush on Lorelai and being able to play that scene,
those scenes were such a joy. And I think that there's there can be a sort of I don't know how to put it exactly, a professional intimacy that goes on between a writer and an actor that I was really blessed, I mean that, to experience with Amy, in that she understood how I spoke and I understood how she wrote. And we'd never, I can't think of one time, not once, in the 7 years that I was on the show when she sat down with me and had a conversation about, here's what I want you to do in this scene. This is what I'm thinking. Because I think I got it. I got her and she got me. And that is the most special thing in the world. It's something I've only ever had also probably with my brother. And so I would love it. I would love it when I had a lot to do, you know?
Right. And so every time you got a script, it was like a little present in the mail.
Yeah.
Like gift to unwrap.
Really? It's one of the reasons I miss TV. You know, I've been doing more movies recently, but I love that feeling that, like, oh, what am I doing in there?
Mm-hmm.
You just look at the envelope for a few seconds before you open it, you know?
And by that, at that point, I mean, we're talking about season three when you became a regular, but, like, was there a point in doing the show where it felt less like a job and I'm going to work and I know some of these people? Did I ever feel more like a family in that sense where it's like, oh, hey, it's Buddy on Key Grip, or I don't know, or did it kind of remain that distance?
You get a familial feeling towards your coworkers for sure. And I got closer to a lot of the people that I worked with. Although I do feel in a sense that it's a little bit of a cliche for actors to say, oh, my TV show is like a family.
Sure.
Because it's not exactly like a family. It's like it's its own unique thing. It's different from a family because, you know, you have to show up one way or the other. Right. So you have love for each other the same way that a family does. But it's a little different from being in a family. But feeling like I belonged and feeling like they, you know, being happy to see everyone at work and feeling like they were happy to see me was, yeah, that feels, there's something familial about that, I think. Mm-hmm.
And so you get the script, and then would there be a table read shortly thereafter with the whole cast?
Yeah. Which is another thing Patterson got wrong. He's like, we did that for 2 years and then quit. I'm like, we did that for like 5 years and then quit. But yeah, so we would have a table read, and which would... The table read would usually be in the lunch hour of the first day of shooting the episode that we were reading.
Wow.
So the whole morning, whatever scenes were shot that morning, we'd be reading, but they'd already been, they were already in the can. So
what's
like
the purpose of the read?
Because we didn't get scripts. I'm sure you guys know this. We didn't get scripts until
very last minute.
At the very, very last minute. I mean, there were times when, there were times when I would have a 6 a.m. Call time for an episode, and I would get the script at 5 a.m.
Wow. Yeah. Did they ever rewrite scenes after you had already shot them? Because you said that they had done table reads.
No, I don't think we didn't, for the most part, we did not reshoot anything. I know in that episode, though, Jews and Chinese Food, I think mm-hmm. it's called, right?
In the Tevye
episode. Wait. Not that episode. Not that episode. The other one. The Festival of Living Art.
Yeah.
The one where I was Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I playing Jesus and Tevye. I got the two confused.
Watch out.
I in the Festival of Living Art, I had to get up and deliver that monologue to
those people.
Dan Palladino handed me that monologue when I got to set.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
wow.
Like I went to work that day having a little bit of dialogue in a couple of scenes, and I like got into wardrobe and everything and then showed up on set, and Dan handed me a monologue. He's like, oh, you're going to do this right now.
Dude,
I need to memorize this. He's like, you can do it. Just do your thing.
I was going to say, was that frustrating a lot, or did you get into the habit of being like, well, I can do this now?
That didn't happen. Like that late of having it give it to me on set, that only happened the one time.
Right.
And that was, I was a little annoyed at the time, but whatever. But, you know, getting the scripts at the last minute was, I always put it in the perspective of, it was never 1/1,000,000th as hard for me as it was for Lauren and Alexis, and to some degree, you know, Scott and Liza and Kelly and, you know, who other people who would have reams of dialogue, who would have like monologue after monologue after monologue. So I always thought, well, however hard it is for me to do this, it's, you know, not anywhere near as hard as it is for them, and they're doing it. So I just got to suck it up and get it done. And that was my job, you know? I mean, particularly by the time you're a series regular, actors are well paid, you know? And so you when you when the job gets hard, you got to work harder. That's the way it is in every profession, you know? So yeah, sometimes it was hard, but, you know, big deal.
You know, I have to imagine, as stressful as it was, there must be a sort of exhilaration about, like, and especially comparing it to the timeline of movies where it's like, you shoot a thing in 2012, you don't get the money for post-production until the fourth quarter of 2012, and then you start shopping around 2013, people don't see it on video on demand till 2014, you know, like movies can take forever. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this show, probably, you know, you get the script, and then a month or two later, you see it on the air.
Yeah.
You can see people reacting to it.
I think about 5-6 weeks later. Yeah. Yeah, totally. No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. I heard, I don't know this to be true, and we can cut this out if it's not, but I heard that one of the reasons that they were delivered so late sometimes was to prevent network interference.
Oh, the script. I mean, I don't know for sure that that's true, but I speculate that that's true, and I feel very certain that my speculation is correct. I don't know that they were always quite so late at the very beginning of season one. And I think that Amy probably got notes from the network that, and Amy didn't like getting notes from anyone. And so she, and rightly so. I mean, I'm 100% on her side. And so she's like, all right, well, then I'm going to deliver these scripts as late as possible. That's not all of it. Also, they were very well crafted and very, you know, and there's a lot of work that went into them. Mm-hmm. So that also contributed to them being late. But I think you're right that probably network interference contributed to how late we got the scripts.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of Sorkin too. For the first 4 seasons of The West Wing, there was not a single script that was on time because he was working on them so hard. So like all the episodes were over budget and stuff.
If only he had a writing staff.
If only.
Do you remember any like big changes that happened at the last minute where it was like the script was one thing and then the changes were completely different that you guys had to acclimate
no, no.
to?
On the contrary, since we got the script so late, they were totally locked by the time we got them. Mm. So we didn't get changes at all. Like we'd get the, you know, we'd have the script right before we started shooting, but then they would be totally locked in place.
Oh, okay.
And
so
they would be, you know, everything, as you know, was verbatim, which I like working like that. Some actors, if not most actors, it drives them nuts, having to be absolutely verbatim on every single.
But that's part of the Howard Hawksian rhythm, and that's exactly how you get the music.
Exactly. I 100% agree.
It's interesting too, because I feel like, especially with comedies now, in the age of Apatow, which does have a place and has certainly a lot of merit, but it's so riffy. You know, like dialogue is, oh, they talk about Star Wars, and then Seth Rogen and Jason Segel can bullshit their way through the scene. Yeah. Whereas, so like, oh, you get that naturalistic rhythm, but then you lose a lot of music.
Sometimes it's very funny, but I find it mostly tiresome. I like well-written and well-constructed comedy. I think people have that misconception about me a lot, particularly, you know, casting people and stuff. They'll be like, oh, you know, you're an improv guy. And I'm like, I'm not an improv guy at all. You know, where I'll go into things and they'll be like, oh, just make the words your own. And I hate it when I go into an audition and they're like, just say it in your own words. I'm like, look, writing this thing is your job. You know, performing it is my job. I will say what you tell me to say. Most actors aren't like that. I think a lot of actors like to be off the cuff or whatever, but also because a lot of actors are lazy and they don't like to learn their lines.
That's true. That's probably the rise of improv in UCB culture.
This is funny.
In auditions.
I remember one time on set, I wish I could remember who it was, but one time on set, one of the actors was changing a cannot to can't. Like, really, that
it was an apostrophe.
Small of yeah. a it was a can't, and they were saying cannot, and then they asked, and then they were corrected by the script supervisor, and they said it doesn't flow off the tongue as well. Can I say you know, can't instead? And they're like, okay, we got to get permission for that. And there was a holdup. There was like a 20-minute holdup while they had to radio back to the writer's room and hear and get and see if they could get permission. And then finally the word came back and the answer was, no, you may not change it. Say it the way it's written.
Which I understand. I feel like cannot is such a like terse way to say something that it's like it means so much more than saying I can't.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's like, you know.
So was there a person dedicated to that on set, like a script supervisor or dialogue coach?
Oh, yeah, script supervisor for sure. The script supervisor would be very busy on
I bet.
On Gilmore Girls because there's so much dialogue and everything was verbatim.
Right.
And I know you've heard about George Bell before too, who was the mm-hmm. the dialogue coach and he was great. And he it wasn't his job to police the words after they were said, but it was kind of his job beforehand. So he would be grilling you on making sure you had everything note perfect.
So did you work with him a bunch before your scenes and make sure? Like, what was your relationship to him?
You know, I actually think I probably worked with him less than a lot of the other actors because – mostly just because I would have my one or two scenes per episode and not much more. And so I would periodically run things with George, but for the most part, I was pretty tight when I walked in the door. When I showed up on set, I would know my lines really well. That's just how I work. I'm still that way.
That's great. That's what we called old pro in the showbiz terms.
That's how I like to think of myself.
Now, I'd be remiss if we went through this interview and didn't ask you about a film by Kirk.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and that process, that was at the end of 219 Teach Me Tonight,
mm-hmm.
which concludes with you doing a freestyle dance to White Lines.
Yeah, that was fun.
Grandmaster Flash.
The great John Polito and the great
Marilyn
Ryskov,
yeah.
Who were so fun to work with. And I remember shooting that very late. Here's what I can tell you about a film by Kirk. I know that I've been told that Amy saw me dancing at a party at a like at a, one of the rap parties or something like that, and thought that it was nutty.
It would be funny if it was a party that you were at and she wasn't. I saw you at a party across the street.
My cousin's bar mitzvah.
So you're at a rap party busting some moves.
I think that I've heard. I don't know. I never asked Amy about this, so maybe it's not true. But I'd heard that she'd see me dancing and that she knew that I was a wacky dancer or whatever. So she put that into the thing. And I don't know. It was one of a couple of things, you know. The dancing in a film by Kirk is one. The evolution of man, when I do the mime thing.
Oh, yes, yes,
was
yes.
another one where, you know, unlike anything with dialogue, when I was always told exactly what to do, those they just said in the, you know, the film by Kirk just said Kirk dances, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so I was like, you know, what kind of do you want me to do here? And the response was, I'll just do your thing, you know. And
like, yeah, so with movement stuff that requires no words, yeah, do your thing.
Yeah,
yes.
Just do your thing. And so I guess I have to take ownership for it. That's my thing.
That is
well, perfect.
That's your legacy.
You know, like, if you want to see my thing, there it is on TV. I mean, you know, I don't know. I remember I was worried about getting very, very tired because I like have a lung condition. I get worn out easily. So it's like, I don't know how many takes you want me to do of this dancing. But
yeah, did you have to do it over and over again?
I wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah.
No, I did. That was like, you know, maybe two takes.
One take Gleason. That's what they call you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gleason. It's so funny. Gleason. Because that's from an episode I wasn't even in. There was a...
Where they give you the last name.
Yeah. There's an episode where Lane says something to the effect of, oh, yeah, a guy in my town had a band called the Kirk Gleason Five, and that's the only time you ever hear that last name mentioned.
Oh, that's funny.
And it just became sort of part of the
the lore of the show that that was my last name. But maybe she was talking about a different Kirk in town, and that's not even my real last name.
Ooh, how do you like and we've that? Been that's mistaken the whole time.
I just blew your mind, man.
Shit. And so, like, okay, so when you were starting to, here's a question I have. When you were starting to do the recurring stuff in season one and two, and then the backstory got built out a little bit, do you feel like you had a pretty good sense of who this guy was? And then, like, when they gave you backstory, it kind of confirmed your suspicions and kind of the work you put into it as an actor?
Yes. I would say emphatically, yes. That, I mean, not specifics. Like, I didn't know that Kirk had a bunch of brothers and sisters. I didn't know that he lived in his mother's basement, but
I wish we would have met his mom.
Yeah. You know, it's great for racquetball. It's very cold, but yes. Great for racquetball. but I knew who Kirk was pretty. So I was on very solid footing with Kirk. It was very, very rare, almost never, that I picked up a script and I thought, what am I going to do with this? I read it as Kirk, you know, from the first time I read it.
Now, and as the show went on, and we talked about the little victories that you got along the way, but he did get, especially in his relationship with Michael Winters, Taylor, got beaten down a lot on the show. And, you know, with the eggs getting missing in the in the town square. Did you study Howard Dean for that one speech?
Oh, yeah. By the way? Yeah.
Okay, great. I did. We just talked about that a few weeks ago. That was one of my favorite moments when I was watching the show. But for those moments where you kind of have a lot of losses, like, as an actor, and given that Kirk is kind of the quote-unquote comic relief on a show that's already very funny and quirky, did that wear on you at all? Did you wish that you got more depth to play like some of the other actors?
That's a tricky question. As an actor, I sort of did from time to time, but I fundamentally understood what my place on the show was. I think that, and we haven't even gotten into this, I think in season 7 when Amy left, it went off the rails a little bit because they didn't get, like, the new team, I think, did not quite understand Kirk exactly. Before that, yeah, I mean, I loved it when I got a little bit more to do. I loved it when Lulu came on and I had, you know, like a date scene with Lulu or you know, some of the stuff we've mentioned, like the basket or asking out Lorelai, like things that seemed a little more grounded in actual human behavior were always more fun to me than wearing a hot dog suit, you know?
Right. A parachute.
But also, if somebody's going to wear a hot dog suit, it's got to be Kirk, right. You know? Both of which were a pain in the ass, by the way, both the parachute and the hot dog suit.
I was going to say, dragging the parachute behind you must have felt like just pulling a ton of bricks.
Oh, it sucked so bad.
Was that the most physically grueling thing you had to do on the show?
In the hot dog suit. The hot dog suit was, the hot dog suit was built, they custom built that thing, and it like rested on my shoulders. It should have been like a harness holding it up, but there wasn't. It was just like the weight of the whole thing was on my shoulders, and it was made out of wood. And like, and so I'm like, this thing's heavy, man. I can't spend too much time in this thing, but whatever. It's, you know, that was my job. I've said before that I wore a hot dog suit, and I basically wore a metaphorical hot dog suit for the whole run of the show.
That's deep, man.
Yeah.
The metaphorical hot dog suit. Oh, boy. Well, let's talk about that transition from season 6 to season 7. Amy and Daniel, as we know, have leave the show at that point, which, by the way, I'm the seasoned expert on the show. I still haven't watched season 7 because I just couldn't bring myself
to. Oh, wow.
So
are you going to watch it with him?
We will. Yeah. Together? And we're going to like try to, you know, we'll get the merit of it as we go on. But for me, it just, the show was so much them and their voice and Amy's voice that it didn't seem, I think I tuned in for 20 minutes of the premiere and I tuned in for the series finale, but otherwise.
Yeah.
That was it.
You know, from my perspective, nothing again. First of all, the new people that came in had a very tough job, you know, coming in, because Amy has such a distinct voice and her fingerprints were on everything in the show. And so to come in and try to essentially
recreate that and give the fans what they want, I wouldn't want that job. That said, it, from my point, I don't know about the rest of the show, from my point of view, it was notably worse. It just, as I said, I just don't think they quite understood Kirk. And I'm not saying that it was, you know, it, even if it's 10% worse, it's when you have a show that's so, where the, you know, that being tight is so important.
The precision of it.
Yes, exactly.
Of the script, the word perfectness.
When precision is so important, when you come in and something's just a tick off, it's that's enough to make the whole thing feel like it's going off the rails. And I, you know, I just had more. I had almost no scenes where I thought that Kirk, that we got to see who he was as a person. I felt like almost all my episodes were like, oh yeah, wouldn't it be funny if we put Kirk in a ridiculous hat, you know, or like if we put, you know, like let's make Kirk walk on stilts, or like, you know, let's put like just all physical comedy stuff. And I like physical comedy. I'm good at it, but there wasn't much else other than that.
It became a caricature kind of version of what, of who your character actually was as a person.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. And for that reason, I was really, foolishly, really ready for the show to end. When it ended, I was like, I was ready to go on and do something else.
That seems to be the general vibe of the people. That's so unfortunate, but that seems to be everyone's vibe from the cast when the show ended, like, oh, this is good, because it would have been a bummer if it had continued for like 2 or 3 seasons more as that, as good as a job is, you know?
Yeah.
But you go on, you go on for a long enough time after the show stops being good, then you start to taint the legacy of what came before.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. I think 2 or 3 more seasons with Amy at the helm would have been really fun.
Yeah.
And then also just from a, you know, personal perspective as an actor, you know, we cut to like 2010 when I could barely buy a job. You know, I was like, you know, I had hubris about how often I would work. And then like, I just, actors have slow years, you know? And then I'm like, why did I want that show to end? I needed to, you know, like, yeah, you know, but yeah, at the time I was like, I'm kind of sick of this, you know, which you're right, is too bad.
That's a bummer. And it sounds like it was pretty shared by everybody.
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak to what everyone thought, but I think so. I know that, I know that 7 years of that much dialogue and those long hours could drive anybody crazy, and I have no doubt that Lauren and Alexis, particularly Lauren, was like this is making me nuts, you know, like there's just so much, like she was just worked to death, you know, and so I can't imagine, you know. As fond of memories that she would have of the show, I can't imagine that she wanted it to go much longer, you know? I could be wrong about that. I'm not speaking for her. I don't know. But it would be hard to imagine.
Even with less to do than, you know, like Alexis or Lauren had in the scripts, did you experience the brunt of a lot of those long hours often when shooting the show?
I did on a day-to-day level, but I didn't do it. You know, I didn't do it for 5 days in a row, weeks on end.
For 6 years.
The way that
for
they
7 years,
did,
yeah.
You know? I would have maybe, you know, my 2 or 3 days on an episode where I was working 16, 17 hour days or whatever, but they didn't stretch out. I certainly am not someone who could complain about the hours on the show. But they were long hours, and it wasn't just, oh, that's the way it is in TV. We had exceptionally long hours on Gilmore Girls. Like it was notably.
Do you remember the longest day?
Long. I remember one of my very first episodes was in the fake snow when we did the reenactment
Love and War and Snow.
Yeah, that one. God, that was very, very long. We went into the all night long, and fake snow sucks. It's like breathing it into your lungs and coughing, and it's just, you know, because it's like a little piece of paper. It's but you know, I know Scott said this too. Any of those long ass scenes in Miss Patty's where it was hot and everybody was in them and we had to get everybody's coverage, and you know, we didn't have a fake set
with walls that, you know, we were actually in that small space.
Which is insane
space.
To me.
Insane.
I forget that insane. All the time, that that is actually not a set.
Yeah.
And that that structure, by the way, still exists on the WB Live.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a monument to ignorance.
Those and long hours. Yeah. It says that. That's the plate on the side.
All of
it.
Those days were incredibly long. Although I will also point out that some of my fondest memories from being on set are from those days, because as long as they were and as excruciating as they kind of were at the time, at some point everyone would start getting sort of punch drunk and slap happy. And Sally and Liz would start breaking would start breaking into old show tunes and telling jokes and like and they got some of those days were really, really fun, even though at the time I was like, oh God, I would like this to end.
And on that note, I mean, we talked about beforehand your relationship with John Cabrera. Do you feel like you developed a special sort of camaraderie with any of the other actors that you worked with?
I feel a special kinship with everybody, although unfortunately, I don't see hardly anyone very much or even speak to anyone so much anymore, with the exception of Keiko, who I play poker with occasionally, and we're, you know, Facebook friends and we talk. And as I told you, John Cabrera has been, you know, my closest friend for over 20 years before predating the show.
Where did you guys meet?
We met at DePaul. He was a year behind me at the theater school.
And you started the theater company together.
Yes.
What was that company called? Do you remember?
St. Ed.
St. Ed.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
A lot to chew on there.
And Greg Henry is a close friend of mine, but that's been more from stuff outside of Gilmore Girls than the show, you know.
Right.
He's friends with my brother, and you know, we did Guardians together. We've done several movies together, actually.
Oh yeah, he was in Slither. Too.
He's in Slither. He's in. Yeah. he just did the movie The Belko Experiment, which I just did, and but you know, I love all those people, and I wish I could see them. It's one of the things that really stung about missing the ATX Festival was I was so excited to go and see everybody again. That's really, I mean, I was excited for the panel and seeing the fans and all that, but really what I wanted to do was see all those people again and reconnect, and I just could not do it. I could not get out of work. And also my girlfriend who I'd been with for 6 years and who hasn't met or gotten to know anybody, and she's never seen the show. or actually, we watched the pilot together a couple years ago, but
which you're not in.
Which I'm not in. Yeah. And it was actually that was always a plus when I would go on a date with somebody, and they were like, they're like, oh no, I haven't seen Gilmore Girls. It's kind of a plus because, you know,
it's a plus not to be known from that show.
Well, it's plus not to be known as Kirk from a woman that
that's
you're
fine.
Gonna
so, yeah,
want.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Exactly.
You know, like if you're on a date with a girl who's like, oh, I always wanted to bone Kirk, you know, that's
an
issue.
Night that could
be an
tonight,
issue.
Baby?
Have you heard the story about the women that would date Steve from Blue's Clues and how they were obsessed with it? And like,
is that a real thing?
Yes, there was one woman who like had the couch from Blue's Clues, and Steve went to her house after the date, and he was just like, I can't, I gotta go.
Wow.
Yeah. So you don't want that.
Yeah. No, I don't. You know, not that it's bad. Like, it's whatever.
But you don't want someone.
But the fact that when I started going out with my girlfriend, she was like, no, I've never seen Gilmore Girls. I don't know who Kirk is. Like, that was just fine with me.
Sure. Because I'm sure some people would like to be confused with their characters. Like, I'm sure Rob Lowe would be okay with, like, oh, you think I'm kind of Sam Seaborn working in the White House, like, super smart campaign writer.
Well, yeah.
You know, like, oh, that's fine. But
we character Kirk, actors have a different experience
exactly.
with those things.
you go home to the girl's place. Here's the pillow that you put over yourself as you ran out of the dragonfly.
Oh, God. Yeah.
What was that experience like?
I don't know. I just sort of have the, like, people are like, oh, is that embarrassing? Is it hard to do? And I'm like, anybody who wants me to, like, anyone who wants me to take my clothes off deserves what they get. I mean, I it's like they if you want me to do it, I'll do it. I'm getting, this is my job. So if that's what's in there, I'll do it. And it's one of the reasons I end up humiliating myself on camera all the time, not just on Gilmore Girls, but in many things that I've done, because I'm actually willing to do stuff and not be like, oh no, I'm not comfortable with that. It's like, not being comfortable with something is not, you know,
it's different for women, but sure. Not being comfortable with something is just not really, shouldn't really be in an actor's vocabulary for the most part.
Right.
As long as you're serving the script. So yeah, you know, I mean, it was ridiculous. I read it. I'm like, this is absurd, but I think I can make it funny. When I watched it back again, I wish they had made me cut my hair for that. I kind of grew long hair for like half of that season. And I look back and I'm like, they should have told me to cut my hair. I was just doing it for the hell of it.
I was surprised that, I mean, because everything we've heard from actors, they do tell you to cut your hair most of the time. Or that's what I thought.
They didn't. I think I was just pushing it. I was like, don't, they're not going to tell me. I'm not going to do it.
I'm a series regular. You can't tell me
to cut
my hair.
And then I had that long hair, which looks absurd. And then what happened was, and then we did that episode where I'm covering my, you know, I'm covering myself with the pillow and I run through with the night terrors. And then we went on hiatus and I shaved my head.
Oh, you had to wear a wig, right?
And so then in the first episode coming back, I got the script and it was like, oh, we pick up right where we left off. And I'm like, guys, my head's shaved now. So I had to wear a wig for that first episode.
Wow.
Ooh, I haven't watched that episode yet. So now I'm going to watch to see if I can tell if it's a wig.
Yeah, be on wig patrol for that one.
Yeah.
We were talking about that episode. That's an 422 is an episode we did for one of our live shows with Jason Mantzoukas a couple weeks ago. And we talked about, because I think I read an interview with you where you talked about the scene and it was fun, blah, blah, blah. But the scene you enjoyed more was that scene between you and Scott, where you're asking him
absolutely
to protect you, kind of getting to that more emotionally grounded, because there's something very sweet about that, about a man asking this guy for something super weird, but mm-hmm. like that he would consent to that. It's
oh,
just
that
like a very
really
lovely
funny
thing.
Too. Yeah. You're exactly right. And that's a perfect example of when I look at the show, how I feel about it. Like, yeah, running through naked with the night terrors, sure, that's funny. But that's not – I don't look back on that as like really something that I loved doing. I loved doing the scene earlier where I'm kind of having this sort of vulnerable moment with Luke. That was a really fun scene to shoot.
And it sounds like season 7 was probably all of the naked running minus the
for the most part,
stuff.
Yeah. I'd have to go back and watch it again. I don't remember all of it. I just remember that was how I felt about it at the mm-hmm. time. And I know that the things I brought, the stilts was in that scene and the crashing the car and into the I think, right? When that scene's
I don't know because
oh, you
I haven't
seen
it. So for me, hearing this stuff is like super interesting.
Do you remember a noticeable change in how the show was like directed or the production of it? Because I know the writing was different, but do you remember if like they were just kind of like in season 7, like, oh, you know, do it with your own words at any point?
No, they didn't do that. But they did, the hours I remember were a little bit better. It was just a little bit more low-key on right. set. I think people were less... People were less paranoid about getting everything perfect, which in some ways can make for a happier workforce, but I don't know that it makes for a better TV show.
And how did you hear the show was canceled? Because we've heard that Lauren Graham got the call while she was at a restaurant, but I'm wondering, like, did they reach out to you, or was it like your agent gave you a call and they were like, hey, the show's done?
I was driving somewhere. I just showed up at my destination, and I got a text from this girl who was on. Do you remember the reality show Beauty and the Geek?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd met this girl Cher at a rap party for the WB, who was one of the contestants on that show, and I got a text from her saying, "Sorry to hear about your show."
Oh wow.
and I saw that and I was like, I'm gonna infer that Come On Girls is canceled.
Oh man.
So
what a way.
Yeah. No, that's how I heard about it. So it wasn't shocking to me. I sort of thought, I mean, at the last minute I thought that maybe they were gonna put it together and we were gonna do one more half season. Like one more six or seven episode season or something. And I'd heard that maybe that was going to happen. I was kind of hoping that was going to happen. Even though, as I said, I was ready to leave, but it's, you know, half a season. I could, whatever. But yeah, I, um,
I had no idea. And then it was good, and then it was done, and then I was like, oh, well, okay. Let's go on to the next thing.
Yeah, what a weird anticlimax, too. Like, was the wrap party for that weird? Because for season 7, the wrap party must not have been bye forever. It was just see you next year, maybe. I don't know.
I don't remember it. I really don't. But I do, what I do remember is that I didn't feel like we had a proper send-off.
Yeah, that's what seems to be the general consensus.
Yeah,
it's so weird to me that they don't notify the actors about the cancellation.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it seems to be priority one.
I mean, you would think.
They don't care, man.
WB or CW at the time.
Yeah, then it was, by then it was CW.
So, I mean, and of course that leads to, let's give E! News another juicy soundbite. Tell us everything you know about the reunion. I'm just kidding. Let's start another news cycle from an actor interview on this more podcast. Talks. There's even more talks.
Here's what I can say about the reunion. Yeah. I can say that there's a willingness there from... I think that there's a willingness from the major people, from Lauren and Scott. I haven't spoken to Alexis about it, but I think that she's... I think there's a willingness on her part. I'm not sure. And Amy... I know that there's not a chance in hell the actors would do it if it weren't Amy in charge of it. Like, nobody's going to go do it if it's not.
I wouldn't watch it if it wasn't Amy.
Well, that's the reason to want to do it is because Amy's the one who should be, it should be ending the way that Amy wanted it to end. And so I know that there's a willingness there, but it would be a matter of A, people's schedules working out, which would be a big problem
for sure.
People, it would be a matter of who's gonna pay for it and make it happen, whether that's Netflix or whoever, like who's gonna put up that money and making sure that everyone, that it's worth the while of all the people coming back. And so there's a lot of ways in which it could fall through, but there's also pretty high demand for it. And if there's high enough demand, that means, I hate to make it about money because I know we don't want to talk in those terms because the fans don't care about that aspect of it. And in a lot of ways, we don't care about that aspect of it either. But the sad truth is that that's what it comes down to. Is everyone going to get paid enough? And is it going to be worth it financially for whoever is putting up the money and all those kind of things? So who knows? And I know that that there were attempts to make it happen. I don't know if those attempts are still floating or if they've fallen through. They're all things that I've heard through other sources. Nobody's spoken to me directly about any of it.
President of WB hasn't called you up and said, Sean, what do we need to do to make this happen?
Get Sean Gunn on the line.
We want Mick back.
Get me Mick on the line. I need that DSL installed ASAP.
What Amy said at the reunion seemed to suggest that she had no hand in any anything that was in the works. So... it's not dead in the water, but it's also not, floating.
It's not living in the water either.
Right.
And it sounds like even if, you shot it for scale in someone's basement, you'd still need the WB to co-sign. You know what I mean?
Because
they own the show.
Yeah, of course.
It's a,
Speaking of which, I'll shoot it in my basement. If the stars are on board,
that would be fun, man.
I'll pay you guys in snacks.
That's kind of what they did as like a sequel to Pineapple Express. They did it in This Is the End with little stick figures and stuff.
We'll do that exact same thing.
Well, Kirk lives in a basement, so we could do it all. We could do the reunion all from Kirk's basement.
A film by Kirk.
Just like Kirk invites everyone over for a party.
From
and
his
then
perspective,
the lights, electricity goes out and they're there for, I don't know, 3 hours, 3 episodes.
How great would that be, though, if it was like a reunion series, and then one of the 6 or 8 episodes was like entirely a film by Kirk, and somehow he convinced Lorelai and and Rory and Luke to all play little parts in the show and stuff.
The sad backstory to that would be like they agreed because Kirk is dying or something.
Oh no, it was his last wish. But then
that's not sad. That's funny.
Him and Lulu have like 5 kids by now.
Oh, for sure.
I don't know. You think they're still together?
I would hope so.
Yeah. Right. Lulu was head over heels for him, man.
That's true.
Well, who wouldn't be? Very attractive.
Oh, well.
He was.
Listen. Now, in going even beyond Gilmore Girls, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about your, you know, you mentioned your relationship and how special it was with Amy in terms of like the writer and the actor, but then also your relationship with your brother, James, and in that relationship too. When did that start? When did you guys start, you know, making stuff together and co-conspiring?
When I was born. I mean, he started making movies. He started making Super 8 movies when... You know, when I was like 3 years old, I think I've starred in his first movie. Or maybe he made some before me, I don't know. But I've always worked with him in one capacity or another, when we could. We've also each had our separate careers. So when, so we've gone off and done our own things. And so when I'm not available for his things, I don't do them. Or sometimes he's done stuff that he didn't write apart for me, or there's nothing, you know, like, so that happens. But when we can, we always work together. And I trust him immensely. And I know he trusts me as an actor. Doing Guardians was really Guardians of the Galaxy. For those who don't know what I'm talking
who live
about,
under
I say
a
Guardians.
Rock.
Doing Guardians of the Galaxy was really the experience of a lifetime, because not only did I love the movie and love being a part of it, but doing it with him and then seeing the success that it got was really amazing. And now we're, you know, getting ready to probably go to do the sequel very soon.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2 Kraglin story, yeah, I believe is what it's called, right?
Yeah. I hope so. But yeah, no, my brother's a maniac. He's the most, you know, as talented as anyone I've ever worked with and professionally. And he understands, like Amy, he has his hand on every single thing that's going on all the time with his movies. There's no stone unturned. And so I love working with him. It's actually very, very easy. I frequently get asked, is it hard because he's your brother? I'm like, it's easier working with him than anybody, because our jobs are very well delineated. I understand generally what he wants all the time. And it's great. I'm assuming that we'll work together for the rest of our lives, you know?
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
And so what people may not know who've already seen Guardians of the Galaxy is that not only do you play Kraglin, but then, of course, you are... What is the official title?
The official title
is
On-Set Rocket.
On-Set Rocket Raccoon.
Yes, which essentially meant that I... Bradley Cooper did Rocket's voice, but he was not cast until two-thirds of the way through shooting the movie. And when we went into rehearsals at the very beginning of the process, I played Rocket. And then for the scenes, so that the actors aren't talking to a blank space or a tennis ball on a stick, I played Rocket. So I learned the lines and got down on my hands and knees. I would get my eyes where Rocket's eyes were, and I just played the role. And I'll be doing that again for the sequel as well.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they shot it before Cooper was cast, because I know that in animation they usually do like the audio first, so they have something to match the action too. But that's crazy to me.
Right? Yeah. No. It wasn't. I mean, it was when the actors are acting in those scenes, they're playing off of me.
Right.
You know.
Well, they're doing a great job.
They are.
And preparing for a role like that, other than like, you're crouching down to get to his eye line, and you're wearing a green screen suit. Like, is there any difference in how you'd prepare for any other role?
No, there's actually not. I prepared for that role as though I were playing Rocket 100%. The difference is after it's shot, is that then I'm only, you know, instead of being 100% or whatever, you know, not 100% because there's editing and all that, but instead of being... the character being totally me, I'm only one slice of the character. It's an amalgamation of me and Bradley and the visual effects team, sort of putting together the pieces and creating this character in post. But from my point of view as an actor, I just prepared as though I was playing Rocket, and that's what I did.
Yeah, you have to. That's amazing, though. Yeah. That's cool to, like, you know, that's not something that would have existed even, like, 20 or 30 years ago. No. Yeah. A collaboration, because film is such a collaborative medium, but then that the collaboration comes down to literally three different sources creating one single character, animators plus voice acting plus an actor on set. That's pretty extraordinary. And then, of course, I mean, by the way, Amy Sherman-Palladino writing and directing a Marvel movie.
Oh, my God. Please.
That'd be awesome.
Put her on Captain Marvel.
That'd be awesome. Wow.
Now that Ava DuVernay is not doing either that or Black Panther, I would love to see Amy Sherman-Palladino's Captain Marvel.
Or James Gunn doing a Bunheads revival.
Oh.
As you God, were.
That would be so messed up. That would be so messed up.
Someone would die.
Somebody would get killed so quickly. Yes.
I'm sure there'd be all sort of the black swan sexual shit.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
Sasha and Boo.
I was not familiar with James Gunn's work until I saw Super, and then, spoiler for anyone listening, the Ellen Page scene, I wasn't expecting it. It ruined me for a bit, but I was also...
Some people hate that. Some people love it. Some people hate it.
It ruined me, but I was also just like, what a brave move, and then I was like, I gotta see the other things this guy has done. And then I realized he, along with you, did PG Porn, which was a series that I had watched that was on Spike a lot, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, talk about PG porn. That experience.
PG
was
porn
like.
Was an idea that I had had like 10 years before we did it. I had an idea shortly after I moved to LA to do to make a short film or two. Like, it shows you how long ago that was. Like, it was before thinking of putting it online and just it was way weirder in my. Vision of it, which is a good example of what's different between me and my brother, is that he has great ideas that he can actually not only see to completion, but they also an audience can respond to them and they'll be funny. I'll have ideas that I think are good, but they'll be very bizarre and then I won't do anything with them either. But I had the idea to take like porn scenes and just have them be as though they're acting scenes, and then just end before there's any sex in them. And I had said that idea, and my brother Brian thought it was funny, and Jimmy thought it was funny, and then whatever, just something we forgot about. And then like 10 years later, Spike TV went to him and asked him if he wanted to do some shorts for online, and he had the idea to go back and do. And then from that point on, it was like really the kernel of the idea was mine 10 years earlier. From that point on, he did everything. He wrote and directed and did all of it. It was just kind of something we did on the side while we were between jobs. I mean, I think some of those are really funny. Some of them are less funny, and
I thought they were hilarious.
Helpful Bus is great.
I was going to say the one where they pick up women and then just drop them off on the side of the road. And we're like, well, there you go.
Yeah, I'm very proud of Helpful Bus, and I like the character I play in that. Jason is a character that I want to bring back somewhere. I don't know where, but I want to like play that character again. I always miss the characters that I play when they're done.
Well, let's get PG Porn 2 funded. If you're listening, tweet out hashtag PG Porn sequel.
Yeah. We're giving up on Gilmore Girls Season 8. Yeah. That's PG Porn Season 2. or a revival of Bunhead so we can find out whatever happened to Sebastian,
Bunheads.
The barista.
I know. That was so fun. That was so fun. First of all, Sutton Foster is just a treat. She's like, she's such a warm person and kind and so professional and great at what she does and just lovely to be around. And then, so it was like, the whole thing felt a little like Gilmore Girls light because it was a lot of the same people. It was Amy's voice, but it wasn't as, it didn't feel as highly charged. It wasn't as tense on set as Gilmore Girls was often. And it was such a great set to be on. And I would have liked to do more. Yeah, I think it's a shame that show didn't go farther. And I actually think that it was I think that show missed by just a couple of years, if not less,
being able to have more seasons. Because I think now you get into a place where people who create content understand that having an entire library of a show is more
so much more valuable.
It's so much more valuable than just having two seasons. And so if they see something and they think that the quality is good, I think people will look at it now and say, well, if we have four or five seasons of this, we can still sell it. It will still have value. We don't have to get viewers every single week. We can just start to create an entire show. And I think Bunheads just missed on that. I think if Bunheads were starting today, they would do five seasons of it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Or even think about like if it was on Amazon Prime instead.
Right.
And ratings are so much less important than the prestige and the critical acclaim that the show was completely showered in. I know. That really bumps me out.
Maybe we got to get a Bunheads reboot.
I would love it. All those girls are busy. And of course, Seddon and Kelly, too. But
reboot.
Yeah. Oh, a reboot. None
just
of the original.
Everything. No.
So it's the same premise, but none of the original people.
No, that would be a shame.
Man. Are there any other fun like anecdotes or stories that come to mind about working on Gilmore that kind of represent some of your best or most fun times on the show?
Let me say this. I will say this. That this was a story I thought of, actually, as I was driving over here. That Sonic Youth was a very influential band to me growing up. I saw them, I think shortly before I turned 16, or I just turned 16, and I saw them open for Neil Young. I was a big fan of theirs, and they played the Fox Theater in St. Louis, a massive theater, and were booed because it was a bunch of Missouri, the Neil Young fans there were not ready for a band like Sonic Youth, this great, post-punk group, but I loved it. I loved it so much, and it was like punk rock, and they were just the more people didn't like them, the louder they played, and it was so great. And I loved Sonic Youth, and I listened to all their. I'd gone back and listened to all their records starting from the beginning, and they were they're a band that was really important in my life. And then I remember from time to time I'd be in my trailer on Gilmore Girls, and people would come by with like a stack of scripts to sign and be like, okay, sign all these scripts. And I think they would send them to different charity auctions and things like that, you know? And I remember one time, a PA came in with a massive Gilmore Girls poster, like the biggest one I'd seen. And I was like, oh, can you sign this? And I was like, oh, this must be somebody important. Who's this for? And it's like, it's for Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth. And I was like, whoa. And that was really intense that I'd had that come around. And then later, I was reading just a couple of years ago, I was reading a New Yorker piece about Kim Gordon, and the interviewer just in passing had visited her home, I think, which is in New England or somewhere in the East Coast, and said that and describing her living room and saying that like above the mantle or on the wall or something was a massive Gilmore Girls poster signed by the cast of Gilmore Girls. And I read that and I really was like, and I actually burst into tears. And I'm not a like super. Well, no, I'm sort of an Irish softy sometimes, but I did like I was thinking of that on the way over because it was something that I remember that made a very deep impression on me, having somebody who had such a profound impact on my life, sort of having that come around and me touching their life in some small way or whatever way was really cool.
Did you ever interact with them when they were on the show?
I never met them.
Oh, wow.
I never met them.
You should reach out to them.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a bit scary.
No, but that is such a cool moment when you realize that everyone that you're a fan of is a fan of someone else too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then when you realize in a weird loop around way that it's you or it's something you're a part of, that's so cool.
It's great.
Yeah. Other anecdotes. I don't know. I feel like almost every episode somebody mentions brings up something. You know, it brings up some sort of memory of something.
Oh, you know, I wanted to talk about, because we've heard that you are indeed a real cat lover.
I am.
In real life.
I am.
So all of the business with Cat Kirk in Deep Fried Korean Thanksgiving.
Yes.
How was that to play? What was that like?
Well, that is also a special episode for me for that reason. That sort of end up getting referenced the most because I do work for a charity called Kit Crusaders, which is a cat rescue organization in LA. And I try to stay involved in animal rescue, particularly cat rescue in general. And so one of the things that they do is they have on their website, and that's Kit Crusaders, K-I-T-T Crusaders. They sell pictures that they've done, photo shoots of celebrities with cats. And I did a very Kirk-esque face holding this cat. And
I think we have one of them.
Do you have one?
Yes.
No, I'd be happy to give you one. It's my favorite picture that I have of myself. It's the one that I choose when I can to sign for fans and you know, just with love from Kirk and Cat Kirk. And people still see it and they're always like, Cat Kirk. And every time I post on Instagram one of my cats, and I do have five cats. I have three that live inside and two that live outside. They were sort of partial, so it depends on how you count. But anytime I post a picture of one of my cats, which is fairly frequently, somebody is always like, "It's Cat Kirk," you know, in the comments. So I remember that that episode well, and I do my girlfriend and I both love cats. They're much easier than children.
Yeah.
I think that's the big takeaway I got from that episode too.
For sure.
Cats are easier than children.
Yeah.
I think Amy would agree.
I think she would too.
Well, I mean, is there anything else we haven't covered?
If anything, I feel grateful for how much the show has touched the fans, and I still to this day love meeting fans who loved the show or people who say that, you know, they watched it with their mother or their daughter and that it was like their special thing, you know, or their son or their father. It doesn't matter to me, you know, but it's a special thing. I wish that I had appreciated it a little more while it was happening. Although I think that's kind of just how life is. I think people,
it's impossible to say that. Yeah, exactly. About, in the moment.
About most things. I miss Kirk, you know, like really I miss, because, you know, character gets into your bloodstream, you know, and for selfish reasons, that's why more than any other, I'd love there to be a reunion. You know, I'd love for the fans to get to see one and whatever, but more than anything, I'd love to just be Kirk again for a minute, you know, because it's why I do what I do.
I'm sure it's a comfortable skin to be in after all these years, too.
Yeah. Yeah, although I think I'd be nervous, like, but a good kind of nervous. I think I'd be nervous to do it again right now. If you were like, oh, you're going to go play Kirk tomorrow, I'd be like, oh, shoot, I got to remember. I got to go watch some episodes and
prepare.
Do some research and remember. Yeah. I'm wondering, I mean, I guess it would be like riding a bike, but I don't know for sure, you know.
A bike that you crash at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. A bike that I drive off a cliff.
Oh, boy. Well, Sean, thank you so much for talking with us. Where can people find you and the stuff you're working on Twitter?
I have this crazy thing on Twitter where I was hacked and I lost my account for years. And then after several months, I picked up another one. I'm like, all right, well, I'm not going to be able to get it back. So I started a second account. So I actually have two Twitter accounts right now.
Ooh.
But just find me at Sean Gunn on Twitter. I'm also at The Judge Gunn on Twitter, but I'm going to start the process of directing those people to at Sean Gunn.
Yeah,
So find me on at Sean Gunn on Twitter. I'm at The Judge Gunn on Instagram, which is a little more My Instagram feed is a little more my personal life stuff, you know?
How did you get that?
Which I don't mind fans seeing. Sure. It's just a little more, it's, you know, you're going to see more of,
cats.
You know, of my, exactly, my cats and what I'm eating for dinner.
How did you get that nickname, the Judge Gun?
My brother Matt says that it's because I'm smug and judgmental, but, I think it's, I don't know. I think it's because I developed a way of saying things, saying my opinion with authority as though they're facts, probably partially as a mechanism for dealing with a big family and not having my opinion discounted or belittled. I say things as though, which are just opinions, as though it's the truth. And people started calling me the judge. I kind of like it. I mean, it's a pretty cool nickname to have, so
sure.
I sort of held on to it. But
it's very authoritative.
You know. I'm wondering as I get older if it sounds stupid, but whatever.
Well, only you can be the judge of that.
And on Facebook, I'm going to change over to a fan page because I've just had my personal page and I accept all my friends, and now I'm maxed out on friends because they do that thing where you get to it. I think I'm maxed out or almost maxed out. But yeah, I'll have a fan page soon, or you can find me on Facebook. But
right on. Well, Sean, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been great to, you know, I'm glad that you ignored your agent at the time.
Me too.
And took that co-star. You helped, you know, create one of our favorite shows ever and brought an iconic role to life. And
thank you, guys. So amazing. Thanks for having me. This is really cool.
Everything you're talking about. And we'll see you next time on Gilmore Guys.
Ba-ba.
Yeah.
Ba-ba. All right, I'm going to go up the stump.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
Oh, I just match you.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-ba.
Ooh, you hear that? That's some Judge Gun right there. Goodbye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.